Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m.
This is Democracy Now!
Well, it's certainly gratifying that so many Democrats have come out against Trump's war on Iran. In many respects, the party's leadership has helped make it possible. Through congressional resolutions, public statements, and party platforms, Democratic leaders have repeatedly issued exaggerated and alarmist statements about Iran's supposed danger to the region, threatened the use of military force, and undermined diplomatic initiatives, sometimes even criticizing Republicans from the right.
As the war in Iran enters its 55th day and the crisis in the Strait of Hormuz intensifies, we'll speak to University of San Francisco professor Stephen Zunis. He says Democratic lawmakers helped pave the way for the war on Iran. Plus, we'll look at how the war could cause a global food crisis.
The disruption of the Strait of Hormuz can push 45 million more people into hunger and starvation. So clearly we need to do something.
Then, are officials and staffers in the Trump administration directly profiting from the war? We'll look at how anonymous traders have made millions of dollars by placing well-timed bets on prediction markets just before President Trump announces major developments in the war. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Officials in Iran say they've collected the first revenue from tolls imposed on ships transiting the Strait of Hormuz. Analysts say the tolls could generate up to $20 million in daily revenue for Iran from oil tankers alone. Meanwhile, the U.S. Navy says it's forced 31 vessels to turn back since President Trump ordered a blockade of Iranian ports on April 13th. It remains unclear when the U.S. and Iran will hold a second round of talks in Pakistan. Iran's President, Masoud Pezeshkian, said three main obstacles are holding up negotiations: a breach of commitments by the U.S., the U.S. naval blockade, and U.S. threats to Iran. In Washington, D.C., the White House said President Trump has not set a deadline for Iran to submit a peace proposal. Press Secretary Caroline Levitt spoke to reporters on Wednesday.
We are completely strangling their economy through this blockade. They're losing $500 million a day. The Karg Island is completely full. They can't move oil in and out. They can't even pay their own people as a result of this economic leverage that President Trump has inflicted over them. So he's satisfied with that as we await their response.
The Senate has rejected another bid to rein in President Trump's ability to use further military force against Iran, marking Democrats' fifth effort to do so since the war began on February 28th. On Wednesday, the Senate voted 46 to 51 to defeat the War Powers resolution, with Senator Rand Paul the only Republican voting to advance the measure, and Senator John Fetterman the lone Democrat in opposition. Three senators, Republican Chuck Grassley of Nebraska, Republican Dave McCormick of Pennsylvania, and Democrat Mark Warner of Virginia, did not vote. The resolution was sponsored by Democratic Senator Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin. Under the War Powers Act, President Trump has until May 1st, 60 days since formally notifying Congress of the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran, to halt all military operations unless lawmakers vote to declare war or authorize the use of force against Iran. The Pentagon has announced that it's removed Secretary of the Navy John Phelan from his post, with no explanation given for his sudden departure. According to the Wall Street Journal, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth fired Phelan after months of tension, reportedly in part because Phelan wasn't moving fast enough to build Trump's so-called Golden Fleet of new warships. Phelan's removal comes as the U.S. Navy blockades Iranian ports and is targeting ships linked to Tehran around the world. Phelan's departure comes just weeks after Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth pushed out Army Chief of Staff Randy George. Phelan was a major donor to President Trump with no prior military service. Since Trump's return to office, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the chief of naval operations, the Coast Guard commandant, and the director of the Defense Intelligence Agency have all been fired from their posts. In southern Lebanon, Israeli forces killed at least five people on Wednesday, despite the 10-day U.S.-brokered ceasefire that's supposed to remain in effect until Sunday. Among those killed was Lebanese journalist Amal Khalil, a correspondent for the daily newspaper Al-Akhbar. Lebanon's national news agency reports she was killed after an initial Israeli strike hit a car in the village of At-Tiri, killing two people before a follow-up strike targeted a building where Khalil and her colleague, photographer Zainab Faraj, had taken shelter. Lebanese officials said they were pursued by Israeli drones and that Israeli troops blocked medics from reaching the injured reporters for hours. Al Jazeera reports Khalil had previously received direct threats from an Israeli phone number on WhatsApp, warning her to stop reporting. The Committee to Protect Journalists regional director Sara Khuda said, quote, "The repeated strikes on the same location, the targeting of an area where journalists were sheltering, and the obstruction of medical and humanitarian access constitute a grave breach of international humanitarian law." Khalil's death is the latest in a series of Israeli attacks on journalists in southern Lebanon. Last month, three media workers were killed in a single Israeli strike. Meanwhile, Haaretz reports Israeli soldiers are looting property from homes and businesses in southern Lebanon, stealing motorcycles, televisions, paintings, sofas, and rugs on a wide scale. A second round of U.S. brokered talks between Israel and Lebanon is set to take place in Washington today, though Hezbollah remains excluded from the negotiations. The FBI launched an investigation last month into New York Times reporter Elizabeth Williamson after she published a story revealing that FBI Director Kash Patel had assigned federal agents to provide round-the-clock security and personal transportation to his girlfriend, country singer Alexis Wilkins. According to the New York Times, FBI agents interviewed the girlfriend, queried databases for information on Williamson, and recommended moving forward to determine whether she'd broken federal stalking laws. Justice Department officials reportedly ended the investigation after establishing there was no legal basis for it and after concluding the probe was retaliation for an article Patel didn't like. This comes as Patel is suing the Atlantic magazine for $250 million, claiming defamation over an article that alleged he's abused alcohol while on the job. Patel responded to the Atlantic's reporting at the Justice Department on Wednesday.
Can you say definitively that you have not been intoxicated or absent during your tenure as FBI director?
I can say unequivocally that I never listened to the fake news mafia. And as when they get louder, it just means I'm doing my job.
On Tuesday, a federal judge in Houston dismissed a lawsuit by Patel against former FBI official Frank Viglione. He joked during an appearance on MS Now that Patel spent more time in nightclubs than at the bureau's headquarters. Georgia Democratic Congressmember David Scott died Wednesday at the age of 80, one day after casting his final vote from the House floor. Scott was the first black man to serve as chair of the House Agriculture Committee. He'd been seeking his 13th term in office despite concerns about his ailing health. He's the fifth member of the current Congress to die in office. His death leaves Democrats with 212 seats compared to 218 members of the Republican caucus. In West Virginia, two workers were killed and more than 30 people injured on Wednesday after hydrogen sulfide gas leaked at a metal refining plant outside Charleston. First responders who rushed to the scene found employees dragging co-workers out of the plant. Seven ambulance workers were among those injured. The industrial incident follows five previous workplace safety citations against plant operator Ames Goldsmith Corporation since 2018. A new report warns nearly half of all children across the United States are regularly exposed to dangerously high levels of toxic air pollution. The annual State of the Air report by the American Lung Association, released on Earth Day, found more than 33 million children live in counties that received a failing grade on at least one of the ALA's measures of air pollution. Meanwhile, nearly 130 million people across the U.S. were exposed to dangerous levels of ozone, with communities of color disproportionately affected. Houston City Council voted Wednesday to gut an ordinance that had limited local police cooperation with federal immigration authorities after Texas Governor Greg Abbott threatened to revoke more than $114 million in public safety grants unless Mayor John Whitmire reversed the measure. Earlier this month, the council had approved an ordinance prohibiting officers from detaining people or prolonging traffic stops solely on the basis of civil immigration warrants issued by ICE. The amendment, passed Wednesday, removes a rule directing the police to wait 30 minutes for ICE agents during encounters and gives officers more leeway to extend detentions during stops. Dozens of people spoke out in opposition to the amendment during a city council meeting on Tuesday. This is Norma Gonzalez, a community navigator at Buri Juntos.
A traffic stop should be just that, a traffic stop. Instead, now police are contacting ICE. Other police departments do not do this. Why should they here in Houston? Since 2025, our Houston police has played sidekick with ICE over 100 times. This is not normal, and our community can feel it. We are afraid to live, to drive, and to call for help.
A panel of federal appeals court judges has upheld a Texas law requiring the Ten Commandments to be displayed in all public school classrooms. On Tuesday, the U.S. Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled 9-8 that the law does not violate the First Amendment's Establishment Clause, overruling two lower court decisions. Plaintiffs are planning to appeal the ruling to the Supreme Court. Tuesday's ruling came as President Donald Trump joined a Bible reading marathon being live streamed from the Museum of the Bible in Washington, D.C. and other locations. In a pre-recorded video, Trump read from a portion of the Old Testament, popular among Christian nationalists. This comes after Trump clashed with Pope Leo over the Iran war and shared an AI image to social media depicting himself as Jesus Christ. Pope Leo has wrapped up his four-nation visit to Africa with a visit to Equatorial Guinea, the first visit to the West African nation by a pontiff since John Paul II in 1982. During his visit, Leo met with prisoners who've been held for years without access to lawyers, called out corruption in African governments, denounced wealth inequality, and criticized foreign exploitation of Africa's mineral wealth.
One of the main drivers of the spread of armed conflicts is the colonization of oil and mineral deposits without regard for international law or the right of peoples to self-determination.
And here in New York City, City Council member Chi Osse was released from NYPD custody on Wednesday after his violent arrest at a protest in support of a homeowner facing eviction. Osse said after his release, he'd sought hospital treatment after officers slammed him to the ground and pressed his face to the concrete. Three others were arrested, including two who were also hospitalized. They'd gathered outside a residence in Brooklyn's Bed-Stuy neighborhood where city marshals were executing an eviction. Osse said the property owners were victims of deed theft, a process where investors take ownership of homes through fraud in rapidly gentrifying neighborhoods where property values are skyrocketing. New York Attorney General Letitia James said she's deeply disturbed by video of Osse's arrest. Meanwhile, Mayor Zoran Mamdani called the footage concerning and said he was investigating. And a correction to one of our headlines, Senator Chuck Grassley represents the state of Iowa. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Amy Goodman will be broadcasting from Seattle tomorrow. We begin today's show on Iran as the crisis in the Strait of Hormuz intensifies. The U.S. Navy is continuing to blockade Iranian ports while Iran is preventing most ships from passing through the strait. On Wednesday, Iran seized two cargo ships. Iran has reportedly also begun collecting tolls from ships seeking to pass through the strait. It remains unclear when the U.S. and Iran will hold another round of talks. Iran's president, Masoud Pezeshkian, said three main obstacles are holding up negotiations: a breach of commitments by the U.S., the U.S. naval blockade, and U.S. threats to Iran. Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, the Republican-controlled Senate has rejected another effort by Democrats to pass a war powers resolution to rein in President Trump's ability to wage war on Iran. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said, quote, "Democrats will continue to force votes on war powers resolutions every week until Republicans decide to put the American people over Donald Trump and end this war." Our next guest has closely followed U.S. policy on Iran for years. Stephen Zunis is a professor of politics and director of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of San Francisco. His new piece for Truthout is titled, "This Isn't Just Trump's War on Iran. Both parties paved the way for disaster." So welcome back to Democracy Now!, Professor Zunis. If you could just begin by laying out your argument, how did the Democratic Party pave the way for this war on Iran?
Well, to their credit, the Democrats have opposed this war, though largely on procedural grounds, Constitution and the failure to account for the economic problems and the like. They've been pushing for war on one level or the other. Obama was an exception. Obama really tried to solve the crisis through the Iran nuclear deal. But hawks in the Democratic Party and in Congress and elsewhere have made a whole series of very confrontational statements, exaggerating Iran's capabilities and the threat to give to the region, threatening military force, undermining diplomatic initiatives. Just for example, the 2024 Democratic Party platform attacked Trump from the right, accusing him of fecklessness and weakness in dealing with Iran. They pointed out four incidents under Trump's first term when U.S. forces were attacked by pro-Iranian militia, and criticizing him for not responding militarily, even though each of these incidents were a direct reaction to a provocation by the Trump administration. They contrasted that with Biden and his ordering airstrikes and the like. And also during the campaign, Harris was also saying Iran's the biggest threat in the world, you know, more so than nuclear-powered countries like Russia and North Korea, China, and also taking this very, a tough line of a confrontational approach without talking about returning to the nuclear deal.
Well, let's hear from some Democrats in their own words about Iran. This is former Vice President Kamala Harris during her first debate with Donald Trump in September 2024.
"The one thing I will assure you always, I will always give Israel the ability to defend itself, in particular as it relates to Iran and any threat that Iran and its proxies pose to Israel."
In October 2024, Kamala Harris appeared on CBS's 60 Minutes and was questioned by Bill Whitaker.
"Which foreign country do you consider to be our greatest adversary?"
"I think there's an obvious one in mind, which is Iran. Iran has American blood on their hands, okay? This attack on Israel, 200 ballistic missiles, what we need to do to ensure that Iran never achieves the ability to be a nuclear power, that is one of my highest priorities."
"So if you have proof that Iran is building a nuclear weapon, would you take military action?"
"I'm not going to talk about hypotheticals at this moment."
And as recently as last summer, Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer criticized Trump for not being tough enough on Iran. In a video posted on social media, Schumer belittled reported Trump administration negotiation attempts with Iran and used the taco epithet, that is, Trump always chickens out.
"When it comes to negotiating with the terrorist government of Iran, Trump's all over the lot. One day he sounds tough, the next day he's backing off. And now, all of a sudden, we find out that Witkoff and Rubio are negotiating a secret side deal with Iran. What kind of bull is this? They're going to sound tough in public and then have a side deal that lets Iran get away with everything? That's outrageous. We need to make that side deal public. Any side deal should be before Congress and, most importantly, the American people. If Taco Trump is already folding, the American public should know about it. No side deals."
So, Professor Zunas, your response to the comments we just played, and to what extent you think they're representative of the Democratic Party overall?
Well, certainly Schumer and Jeffries are among the more hawkish members of the Democratic caucus. We've seen that regarding Israel and other issues. But we've also seen very one-sided resolutions passed by a number of Congresses with overwhelming Democratic support. We've seen Democratic Party planks that are really hawkish as well. I think of these 2016 Democratic platforms as we will not hesitate to use military force if Iran violates the agreement, even though there were already enforcement mechanisms within that agreement that would automatically put sanctions back in, even though it would have taken years for Iran to rebuild their nuclear program. Similarly, in 2011, Congress passed, or the House passed a bill that fortunately did not pass the Senate because of constitutional questions and Obama administration opposition, that would have prohibited any representative of the U.S. government from even meeting with any representative of Iran. The following year, there are a series of resolutions saying that there will be no, we will not rely on containment towards the supposed Iranian threat. And again, these are passed by overwhelming bipartisan majorities, 90% of Democrats. And indeed, there's one that was supported by a resolution supported by every Democratic senator that said if Israel feels compelled to use military action in its self-defense of Iran, we'll give them military and other support. In other words, not just if they're attacked by Iran, but if Israel attacks first.
And Professor Zunas, this House vote was considered a concurrent resolution. If you could explain what that means, and then also say what you expect to happen. Federal law requires congressional approval for military actions extending beyond 60 days, and the war in Iran started on February 28th. So we are approaching that deadline.
Oh, the War Powers Act was passed in 1973 in response to the Vietnam War. It had bipartisan support, in fact, enough to override President Nixon's veto. And basically what it did was underscored what is quite clear in the U.S. Constitution, that only Congress has the right to declare war or authorize military action. I mean, as Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces, the President has the power to defend the United States if attacked. I mean, back in the late 18th century, if Congress wasn't in session, so it would take weeks for people to get back to Washington, and so they wanted to give the president the leverage to defend the country. But any offensive military action, it was quite clear it was a congressional prerogative. In fact, the War Powers Resolution gives the president more power than the Constitution said, because it gives him these 60 days. But the failure to enacted here is quite disturbing. Now, again, to the Democrats' credit, they are united in large part in support of this. I'm not taking the argument in this article that both parties are the same. I don't think a Democratic president would have launched this war if not for the moral or legal reasons, simply because they would have listened to the intelligence experts, the military leaders, and others who have said this is going to be a mess. It's not worth doing. But at the same time, the climate that the Democrats have helped lay in these 20 years of hawkish statements and resolutions and the like really made Trump's job easier and has enabled him to thus far get away with it.
And if you could comment also, Professor Zunas, on the significance of 40 Senate Democrats voting last week to block weapons to Israel. 13 of those senators voted to block weapons for the first time.
This is significant, and I think it reflects the power of the growing movement in the United States, not just the pro-Palestinian crowd, but those who just simply for basic human rights grounds do not want to give unconditional aid to a country that's engaged in massive war crimes in Gaza and Lebanon and the West Bank and elsewhere, not to mention, of course, this war with Iraq, because people like Schumer and those Democrats that voted against this resolution of disapproval. I mean, they can't say they oppose the war while at the same time providing Israel with unconditional offensive military aid. But in many ways, this reflects what we've seen historically regarding Vietnam, regarding Central America, regarding South Africa, Iraq, etc., that the Democrats tend to start with a very hawkish position, but eventually they get pressure from their constituents where they get the message very clear that if they want to be reelected, if they want to have support, they're going to have to side with the anti-war majority and not for the administration's militaristic policies.
And Professor Zunas, what about the Iran nuclear agreement, which of course was signed and formalized by the Obama administration? How many Democrats, in your view, now would support renewed, to go back effectively to the Iran nuclear deal?
It's hard to say because they haven't been talking about it. I mean, even, again, to get Schumer, Jeffries, and others who are opposing the war, they always say, oh, we should not allow Iran to get a nuclear weapon, really underscoring that point. And though questioning the military action, I have not heard them say, let's go back to the nuclear agreement, because not only would that make it physically impossible for Iran to develop a nuclear weapon, while that was in effect, Iran was moderating its policies. It was not goading on these proxies in Iraq and elsewhere. They were not engaged in confrontational activities. Indeed, if you look at the whole history of U.S.-Iranian relations since the revolution in 1979, when the United States has been more accommodating and more towards diplomacy, it's moderated Iran's overall foreign policy. When it's been confrontational, they become more provocative and more militant. Similarly, with the domestic repression as well. When there has not been an active threat, there's been a little bit of a space opening, both for reformists within the system and people outside the system trying to change it. But when there's threats, when there's war, that's when some of the worst crackdowns have taken place. So, again, I am really perplexed about why we're not hearing a call for return to the agreement. It was not in the last two Democratic Party platforms, and we have not been hearing it from the halls of Congress.
Professor Stephen Zunas, thank you so much for joining us, professor of politics and director of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of San Francisco. We'll link to your new piece for Truth Out titled, This Isn't Just Trump's War in Iran. Both parties paved the way for disaster. Coming up, we look at how the war on Iran could cause a global food crisis. Back in a minute. Say That by Deerhoof. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Nermeen Sheikh. We turn now to the risks of a global food and hunger crisis if the Strait of Hormuz remains closed to shipments of fertilizer, oil, and natural gas. The Food and Agriculture Organization, or FAO, warned last week that a prolonged crisis in the Strait could lead to a global food catastrophe due to rising oil prices and disruptions to the fertilizer supply chain. A top United Nations official echoed the FAO's warnings Wednesday, saying that the closure of the Strait was creating a crisis in the agricultural industry in Asia and Africa. According to the FAO, India, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, Somalia, Sudan, Tanzania, Kenya, and Egypt are among the countries most at risk from the Strait remaining closed. Jorge Moreira da Silva, executive director of the UN Office for Project Services, said the UN has established a task force focused on fertilizers and supplies of raw materials in order to prevent a humanitarian crisis.
The disruption of the Strait of Hormuz can push 45 million more people into hunger and starvation. So clearly we need to do something.